Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We have two guests today. Joining us from by telephone from Palmer is obstetrician gynecologist Susan Lamaggi. She is a big advocate of women's health. She's very much into the leadership of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and she's a breast cancer survivor. In the studio is Anchorage cancer specialist Dr. Jeannie Anderson. Dr. Anderson is the director of medical cancer research at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Our topic today is the personalized aspects of breast cancer. What has changed? How have we improved the outcomes? What's the current state of the art? To reach us in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can email us at any time during the program at line1, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Susan and Jeannie, welcome to Line One.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good to have you both here. And one of the reasons we're here is, besides breast cancer, is that there is a breast cancer conference that's going to be held October 22nd at Providence. When do you want to tell us a little bit about this conference and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Yes, the title of the conference is Breast Cancer Update for Primary Care Physicians, Personalizing Care. And it's going to be at Providence Cancer Center this Friday, October 22nd. It's an all-day conference. And if you're interested in registering as a healthcare provider for CME, the number to call is 212-8541. And it's very cheap CME. It's $140. But we are also inviting breast cancer survivors to come. We think it's very important that they learn about the latest in breast cancer as well, because frequently when women are diagnosed with breast cancer, they get their second and third opinions from their friends and family. So we want people to know about all the changes. Breast cancer has changed so much in the last 10 years. So if you want to register as a survivor for the conference, the charge is $35, basically for meals. The other costs are being underwritten by Providence. You should call Rose Lottie at 212-2785. And for me, the theme really is one size doesn't fit all, because as I mentioned, the NIH came out with a consensus statement about breast cancer in the year 2000, basically saying that everyone needed chemo. And boy, that was the shortest-lived consensus statement that they ever made. The research has been amazing in the last 10 years. We now have lots of diagnostic options, lots of treatment options. And assuming that all women want the same thing is a real mistake. So that's why we're doing this conference. And we sold out last time. We had standing room only. So if you are interested in coming to this conference, you should call those numbers. For CME, it was 212-8541. And for breast cancer survivors, 212-2785.
Do you want to mention, I know Lily, I think her name is Shockley, is going to be here from Johns Hopkins. She is very much involved in patient education in particular. I've actually interviewed her before on the program. And perhaps other guests that you want to mention that are going to be there?
Oh, yes. Lily is one of my heroes. She is a three-time cancer survivor herself. She had premenopausal breast cancer twice, and then again, she did develop uterine cancer from tamoxifen therapy. And she's the author of many books. She's written a primary care book for physicians and healthcare providers, lots of books for patients. Navigation is her most recent one, but she also writes about her own personal story. I think she's got seven titles, and we're hoping that we can get a bookseller there selling her books so that she can sign books. But she's a very strong advocate, very knowledgeable. She's on the Avon. She does a blog online through Johns Hopkins, as well as doing the Avon Breast Cancer official call-in and write-in blog, too. And then some of our other experts, because the United States Preventive Services Task Force was so misinterpreted, we've got Dr. Robert Smith from the American Cancer Society coming, Dr. Petiti from the USPSTF, and then Dr. Constance Lehman, who is from the University of Washington, and she is president of the American College of Radiology. And they're going to spend the morning sort of talking about the different approaches to breast cancer screening, which is really, I think, becoming more individualized and personalized, although there's lots of controversy still about that. And then we're going to have local experts like Dr. Anderson talking about treatment. We're going to be doing a radiology update. And then we're going to be talking and hearing from survivors themselves about what sort of things they considered as they made their individualized choices for care.
Jeannie, let me get you into this. How long have you been treating breast cancer?
Let's see. I haven't thought about that in a while. Probably about 20 years.
So,
but I focused much of my practice in the last 8 or 9 years on breast cancer.
So there have been large changes and large improvements in outcome?
Yes, absolutely. There's been a lot of improvements both in survival and also decrease in what we term morbidity, meaning complications and side effects of treatment. Mm-hmm. We're getting smarter, but we still have a long ways to go.
And I know, Susan, that you really wanted to particularly get the point across is that the long-term outcome of breast cancer is dramatically different than it might have been 15 to 20 years ago.
Well, yeah. When women get diagnosed with breast cancer, and even when doctors tell patients, or primary care docs tell their patients that they have breast cancer, there's still an assumption that these women are going to die of breast cancer. You know, we know now that women with early stage breast cancer, stages 1 and 2, 90% of these women are surviving 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, again, I want to say that I'm a survivor, and my mother also had breast cancer. And, you know, breast cancer, dying of breast cancer, having recurrence for breast cancer isn't necessarily the biggest long-term health risk that we face. And I was flying over the Pacific Ocean yesterday on the way back from a gynecology conference in Hawaii, and I thought of this terrible joke. And my kids tell me I'm a terrible joke teller. But, you know, I want you to realize I'm a survivor. I'm looking out over the Pacific Ocean and remembering this joke. You know, that there's a woman on a plane flying over the Pacific, and the pilot announces that both engines have failed and we have to prepare for a ditch in the ocean. And this woman becomes hysterical. And people around her ask her why she's becoming so hysterical. And she says, "My doctor told me I was going to die of breast cancer." And in reality, we're much more likely to die of heart disease or motor vehicle accidents or the other kind of common daily things that we don't think about, but we focus so much on cancer that we scare ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, humans are not particularly good at understanding risks, that's for sure. I mean, the most dangerous thing we all do every day is drive to an intersection, I think is one of the statistics that I've seen. Jeannie?
What Susan mentions is a point that I'd like to make from a treatment standpoint, and she's absolutely right that we have to pay attention to other medical problems the patient has and balance treatment options with what are the risks. For instance, if somebody has some underlying heart disease, we might want to specifically avoid certain drugs. Or if they have osteoporosis, we might want to avoid other drugs. So we really do need to pay careful attention to other medical complications and preventing them while adequately treating the cancer.
And I want to also define some terms. Susan mentioned stage 1 and stage 2. What do we mean by that exactly, Jeannie?
Stage 1 is defined as patients having no more than a 2-centimeter mass in the breast and lymph nodes that have been assessed and are negative for involvement with cancer. Mm-hmm. And then stage 2 is if tumor is either large, over 2 centimeters in size, or we start to see a few positive lymph nodes.
All right, let me remind our listeners, we're talking about actually the personalized approach to breast cancer, why it's changing, what's the benefits of that, not only in making risk assessments and deciding how we might figure out individuals' risks and how we might monitor for those risks as well as treatment. And the idea we have is to do most of the personalized risk assessment first and then the personalized treatment later. But if you're listening and you've got calls, don't hesitate to call 550-8433. That's our local number here in Anchorage. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. If you're need to make a toll-free call, and our email address, line1@ksaa.org. Susan, let's start with what we mean by personalized risk of, assessment. What are the factors that women might need to be aware of that determine some differences in risk between individual women?
Well, what I want to do first is hit the highest risk, because certainly not everyone's risk is equal. There are some women at extremely high risk of getting breast and ovarian cancer, up to an 85% lifetime risk, and this is related to the risk of carrying the BRCA1 and 2 genes. And we want to educate doctors as well as patients to be aware of this and to remember to think about sending these women for genetic counseling and referral for possible genetic testing. You know, this is the 10-year anniversary of the Human Genome Project, and I think breast cancer has really benefited from this research. And I just want to point out Dr. Francis Collins, who's head of the National Institute of Health, discusses this thoroughly in his latest book, The Language of Life, DNA and the Revolution in Personalized Medicine. So that if you have a strong family history of breast cancer, particularly with relatives diagnosed at a young age, say less than 50, you may want to ask your doctor about getting referred for genetic counseling and testing. And Providence Cancer Center is very fortunate. They've got a wonderful certified genetics counselor, Maggie Miller. She's very talented, personable, and they offer free counseling through grants and philanthropy. But, you know, the testing's expensive, but most insurances do cover it. And so if you're interested in getting your personal risk assessed through this counselor, the phone number there is 212-6874. And then the National Cancer Institute also has a great website. They have a great page of questions about BRCA1 and 2. You can check out that. It goes through the GALE model, or a modified cancer, personalized cancer risk model. And, you know, we forget sometimes when we're counseling women and we're quoting that 1 out of 8 lifetime risk of breast cancer that everyone knows about. Bottom line, 7 out of 8 women will never get breast cancer during their lifetime. But 10% of women do have up to an 85% chance of getting cancer. And we just need to do a better job of finding those highest risk women.
Okay. How about other risks?
Okay, well, the traditional risk factors are, number one, being a woman, although men do get it as well. And I think there was a good article in Sunday's paper about male breast cancer. But clearly, being a woman is the major risk factor. And then the other risk factor is getting older. That 1 in 8 means if you've lived to age 97, you do have a 1 in 8 risk. If you're in your 20s, by the time you're age 30, it's like 1 in 2,000 risk. By age 50, it's 1 in 50 risk. By age 60, 1 in 25. Clearly, the older you are, the higher risk you do have of getting breast cancer. You know, and then there are lots of other risks, and we can go through those as well, but I just want to emphasize, I personally feel sometimes that we do a lot of fear-mongering relating to breast cancer risk, and we don't talk enough about heart disease, which is a 1 in 2 lifetime risk, and that's what we're much more likely to die of, even if we get breast cancer.
Jeannie, you have some comments?
Well, a few other risk factors, just to give a couple other specific ones. Some combination hormonal therapy, combination of estrogen and progesterone, can increase the risk. People who've had at a young age high radiation exposure, but that's mostly childhood cancer survivors. But there's three factors that affect risk that are people have control over and potentially reversible, and that's obesity, alcohol intake, and exercise. And then I can give some specific information if people want more details. But trying to minimize alcohol intake to no more than one drink a day, and to try to exercise at least some sort of, you know, moderately vigorous exercise 4 or 5 times a week, maybe up to 30 to 60 minutes, and trying to maintain a healthy weight, all can help decrease risk of breast cancer.
Okay.
Yes, and I agree with that. You know, and also Ashkenazi Jewish women have a higher risk, so if that's in your genetic background, that's something to be concerned about. DES exposure. You know, as a gynecologist, I have a personal feeling that estrogen is a natural hormone for us. And what Jeannie's referring to is, I think, the studies about postmenopausal hormone use, which did have a tiny increased risk, about an extra 1 in 1,000 over the first 5 years of therapy. And a lot of women do have quality of life issues going through menopause that they do need to discuss with their individual physicians. But, you know, we do, for example, for gene carriers, re-recommend birth control pills to help cut down the risk of ovarian cancer. And there's just a recent study suggesting that the types of progesterones in birth control pills may actually reduce breast cancer risk. There's a lot of research we have yet to do. But I just want to speak up a good word for estrogen, because for women, it's part of our makeup.
Okay. Before we move on, we do have a caller. I want to take Susan's call. Susan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, thank you. I am a 52-year-old woman who was just diagnosed in July with breast cancer, which took me completely by surprise and came out of the blue. And now I'm in chemotherapy, had a mastectomy. But my comment is, I'm very impressed with the medical care I've been given up here, and the concerns and the positive aggressive behavior of the parties involved to help me go through this. And you know, there was no choice. It was either, I looked at it black and white, either you live or you die. So you lose a breast, but you live. So it's a very simple decision for me. I don't know other women, but
you mind if we just ask I guess I'm butting in, so let me apologize for doing that. Also, tell us a little bit, if you don't mind, about how you came to the diagnosis and then your experience with the medical establishment. And the reason for me asking that is that it's very, very clear that information transfer is extremely important. And in areas that are moving as fast as some of the cancer chemotherapy, it's part of the reason for the conference that's being put on, is to make sure not only the public but physicians in particular are aware. So kind of tell us, if you don't mind, your story.
Okay. Normal mammogram going on for the last 10 years, but then I got stubborn and decided I didn't want to do it for a couple of years. And so I had a cyst in my left breast that was monitored, but it was just nothing of importance after it had been reviewed, you know, through procedures, you know, just doing a biopsy. And so I didn't really think about much of it. And then last year, when I had missed my yearly mammogram, my doctor said, get into the doctor's office in July and take care of it. And so after I went to the mammogram, had it done in July, and they found a little spot, then it was biopsied, and then the cancer came around, or it was diagnosed with cancer. And then at that point, my primary care physician just set me up with a surgeon to say, you need to talk to this person, then we're going to take care of it. Mm-hmm. So I was a little lax on the yearly mammogram testing, but I thought every other year would probably suffice, my own self-diagnoses. And mm-hmm. having known that I had some cysts in the breast in the past, but I wasn't worried about it. But when it came back in July that I had some cancer, then that was quite the rude awakening.
Okay.
But the information that I was given by my primary care to the surgeon was very quick and very positive. And I think it's just that I have a strong self-awareness that, you know, you got to take care of yourself, because I have a teenage daughter and I want to see her grow up. Mm-hmm. So, but when I spoke with my team, the radiology and chemotherapy doctors, one of the doctors had mentioned that there's a woman who had come in and wanted permission not to have her breast removed, because she was so, you know, attached, and that was her life was her breast, and she didn't want to have the breast removed, but she was having stage, you know, a higher stage than I was, just stage one. So mm-hmm. I think having a good rapport with your primary care physician, but I, you know, was essential, and then just trusting that the doctors that would be working with me in a positive method.
All right. Well, you know, your story leads us to a number of important questions about screening and how often and the new recommendations. So if that's okay with you, I'm going to ask you to kind of leave us, and then we're going to use that to kind of jumpstart some of the other discussion. Is that all right with you?
That is. And just one comment, though. Yeah. I was back east in September, and I read in the Sunday paper that the use of a mammogram to diagnose breast cancer in women over 50 was not as important. And I think I misread, I hope I had misread that article, but I don't think I had. And I was like, no, I was somebody who would never have found it if I had not had the mammogram.
Yep. And it's a complicated issue. It's not only finding it, is what would have happened if you would not have found it, and that's where things start getting a little messy. So we're gonna we'll move on to that. Thank you very much for your call.
All right, bye bye.
Jeannie, let me ask you first: is this, what's typical or atypical about this woman's story?
It sounds very typical. I don't know what the average age of my patients are, but I'd say somewhere around age 50. I see a lot of patients in their 40s and 50s, many of whom are diagnosed at their mammogram, and they're often stage 1 or stage 2. And so despite the questionable recommendations in the national guidelines, I think very strongly that I think annual mammogram starting at age 40 definitely picks up earlier tumors, much less intensive treatment needed, better prognosis, and they can get on with their lives.
I don't remember what Susan said specifically, but she said something about reading something in the paper about, I don't remember, the necessity. I don't know if you guys remember, Susan or Jeannie, what she said exactly, but was the point related to the necessity and frequency, do you think, of or utility of mammography? And this gets to the new recommendations is where I'm trying to get.
Well, personally, I think the USPSTF guidelines or the Preventive Services Guidelines are excellent science. And I think that the problem in them lies in misinterpretation. And there's no question that women over at age 50 and beyond should at least get every other year mammograms. One thing that I'm struck with this particular Susan story as well is how that she was somehow feeling it was a little guilty or that it was her fault, and that, you know, that she was a little late in getting a mammogram. And I'll tell you that that's almost universal when I see women, that they feel that they should have done something differently. And, you know, mammograms don't prevent breast cancer. Even if you've gotten them regularly every year, you could have had a mammogram 3 months earlier and develop a new lump and bump and still have a later stage cancer with positive nodes. There is an error rate with mammograms. They're not perfect. And the bottom line is that the guidelines, I think, no one says that you don't need to have mammograms in your 40s. And if you want to, I can just read those guidelines for you. Because the bottom line is women age 50 to 74 every other year. This is routine screening mammograms for average risk women. And then if you want more frequently or starting younger, they recommend discussing it with your physician, because not every woman's alike. Everybody's individual. Some women, those highest risk women, they need not just a mammogram, they need an MRI every year, every other year. That's up for debate. But getting a yearly mammogram for women in their 40s is not enough, which is why we need to educate physicians as well as women that their individual and personal risk takes precedence over one-size-fits-all public health recommendations.
Yeah, my understanding, and absolutely I am not the expert here, but I've looked at them and I've interviewed the chairman of that, is that the whole issue between 40 and 50 to some degree gets to be this individualized risk, personal feeling, I can't sleep at night without knowing, other factors, and I forget, there was another point. Oh, and that there is a risk to over-diagnosing and over-treatment and the side effects for that. And that's where the 40 to 50 gets a little bit cumbersome, but the over 50, it's a little bit more clear-cut and the evidence supports it. Is that fair
exactly.
to say?
Over 50, it's a no-brainer every 2 years. And for that decade for women in their 40s to 50s, for most women, the risk of cancer is very low, but you have to realize there are those individualized risk factors. And if you look at the decade between their 40s and 50s, clearly we are over-diagnosing cancer. The New York Times had a good article this summer telling the stories of women who had gone through surgery and chemotherapy when they didn't have cancer at all.
Right.
And if you just look at screening women in their 40s and 50s, half of those women are going to end up having extra tests during that decade. Additional mammogram views, ultrasounds, even biopsies. And so there really is the risk of over-diagnosing these women without an improvement to their overall mortality.
Okay. Let me let Jeannie make a comment, and then we're going to have to take a short break. Jeannie?
Susan, I guess I have a somewhat different perspective of some of the comments you're making. I think there are a lot of experts that would agree completely with you, and I think there are a lot of experts who would have a different bent on some of those things. The American Cancer Society recommends annual mammography beginning at age 40. And in fact, a review article I have here from one of my medical journals kind of goes into great detail about the U.S. task force, and there's a lot of methodological concerns about that that have been raised. So I think it is somewhat controversial. I think a lot of women from age 40 to 50, it really depends on if they're willing to accept a number of procedures being done for an ultimate diagnosis of or not being found to have cancer. There are lives saved, and especially there's a number of large studies that really do show a significant savings of lives with early mammography starting annually. I also would also comment that I don't think here in Anchorage community that we over-treat breast cancer. I think our pathologists are extremely careful and conscientious, as are radiologists. So I guess I'd be a little concerned about having the public think that we over-treat and people are getting chemotherapy when they don't even have cancer. I'm a little concerned it might scare some people away from having mammography be done.
Yeah, and I think that needs to be qualified. When we talk about overdiagnosis, we're talking about the whole country, and it may be different in a small town in Tennessee as opposed to a major medical center and how well that I mean, so those are things that I think what I hear you bringing up, Jeannie, that we need to put in perspective.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
Is that true? All right. I apologize. We'll come back to this. I want to take a short break because I need to. Today we're talking with Balmer obstetrician gynecologist Susan Lamaggi and Anchorage cancer specialist Jeannie Anderson, and our topic is breast cancer, but more particularly the personalized care that needs to be thought about in the care of this condition. If you've got questions or comments, don't hesitate. Give us a call at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@kska.org. We'll continue after this short break.
KSKA is listener-supported radio. Hello, I'm Steve Heimel, host of Talk of Alaska, and we're inviting you to call right now, 550-8484, and pledge your financial support to keep local and statewide news and information programs going strong on FM 91.1. Toll-free, the number's 800-478-5256, or you can pledge online, kska.org. 91.1 FM is where to tune for local, statewide, and national news and information. Each Monday, you tune into your health with KSKA's locally produced program, Line 1, Your Health Connection, with Dr. Thad Woodard. The call-in invites you to talk to experts in the health field on issues that affect your health and your family's well-being. Dr. Woodard keeps you connected with your community and offers insight and information on issues that matter to you. Call in with your pledge of support, 550-8484 or 800-478-5256, online, kska.org. KSKA, the Alaska Public Radio Network, NPR, and the BBC all work together to provide the best news and information public service on radio today. you rely on the Alaska Public Radio Network. And KSKA relies on you and your financial support to keep this public service healthy and vital. In Anchorage, call 550-8484, toll-free 800-478-5256, or online, kska.org. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today by telephone is a Palmer obstetrician, gynecologist, and women's health advocate, Susan Lamaggi. And in Anchorage, with us today in the studio is Anchorage cancer specialist, Dr. Jeannie Anderson. We're talking about personalized health care for breast cancer. And before we get back to the issues at hand, I want to also just mention that you can be a participant in trying to decrease 20,000 unnecessary deaths each year by just getting your flu vaccine. If you have any interest in that and can't afford it, I can let you know that there is a free clinic that's going to be held October 28th from 2 to 7 p.m., October 28th from 2 to 7, and Saturday, October 30th from 9 to 2 p.m. for those of you in the Chugiak, Eagle River, Peters Creek area. It'll be at the Chugiak United Methodist Church, October 28th and October 30th. All right, so welcome back, Jean and Susan. Do we need to speak anymore about the guidelines, or can we move on, or should we move on to other?
I would like to just do my little chance for a rebuttal here.
Okay.
Because I do think that the USPSTF guidelines will eventually be accepted, but if you want to hear a good discussion, I encourage you to come to the program, the Breast Cancer Conference, this Friday at the Providence Cancer Center, because we're going to be having national experts debating this. You know, bottom line is multiple national organizations have accepted and approved them. The American College of Physicians, which is the national group of internal medicine doctors, the American College of Preventive Medicine, the American College of Family Physicians. Dr. Susan Love is in support and has written multiple articles about these. And there are even breast cancer advocacy groups, such as Breast Cancer Action, which are scientifically based groups that do support this. And I think that the big issue was the way the results were communicated. And again, because the public is not sophisticated about understanding statistical risks and the difference between randomized controlled studies and observational data, there are a lot of, you know, healthy patient biases and reporting errors that get included. The bottom line right now is that 50% of all breast cancers in the U.S. are still discovered by palpation, by the woman herself or by the physician. And I just do want to encourage women to be breast aware. If you notice a change in your breast, and, you know, you don't have to do a special breast exam. Women have been doing good enough breast exams for years while they shower, while they dress. If you notice a change in the appearance of your breasts, if you notice a lump, if you notice skin dimpling, if you notice discharge, call your doctor right away. That's how we are diagnosing breast cancer still. It's not just mammography. And, you know, mammography has, if you accept the best reduction in all the studies, it's up to a 30% reduction in death. But pap smears have reduced cervical cancer deaths by 90%. And colonoscopy for reducing colon cancer, that's a 60% reduction in death. A 30% reduction in death maximum, although most studies show closer to an average of 15%, 30% is still not good enough. We need a better test. And the Journal for Cancer, National Cancer Institute, emphasized that in June, that the error rate and misinterpretation by mammography, and frankly, mammography not even seeing the cancer, you know, that's really important to recognize that mammograms don't pick up all breast cancers. And that's why doing an MRI for those highest risk women is so important.
I'd like to just get back, and we can talk about that some more if we need to, but I want to eventually get into some treatment issues. But Jeannie, one of the things you had commented on earlier was that alcohol, exercise, and weight are significant risk factors. And I, if I'm not out of line by saying I just saw a recent review of an article that basically, as I recall it, it said that if women can follow those recommendations despite what may be significant genetic risk, they can decrease their risk of breast cancer around 25%, and that's similar to what the normal population of women is. So that it's a significant, that those three things are significant preventative measures that women can do to help prevent breast cancer.
Right. I agree. I think one of the reasons why breast cancer incidence is increasing is due to the, quote, obesity epidemic, mm-hmm. end quote, mm-hmm. that gets referred mm-hmm. to in the newspapers. So mm-hmm. I think preventing or perhaps losing weight, or preventing weight gain, especially when you're younger, so trying to keep younger women at a healthy weight mm-hmm. would be critical for helping prevent cancer. In patients who have a genetic susceptibility, I don't know the statistics to know how much risk reduction can be done with lifestyle changes, but that really leads into the next topic for breast cancer prevention, that is medical mm-hmm. management. And there are very good, safe medications that can reduce the risk of developing breast cancer by nearly 40 to 50%. Tamoxifen is the gold standard, but there's also raloxifen, known as Evista, that has significant improvements in decreasing incidence of breast cancer. So for select patients, those are appropriate.
And who are those select patients, and how does that work?
Well, Susan mentioned that one can see online something called the GALE model, and you can get that on the National Cancer Institute website. That's a model that gives an estimate of what a woman's risk of developing breast cancer is, I believe, over the next 5 years. It takes into account age, when the patient's period started, how many breast biopsies they've had, an amount of positive family history. I think there's a few other factors, but it is a somewhat simple calculation, and then gives an estimated risk of developing breast cancer over a certain period of time. And then it's, to some extent, a judgment call whether cutting that risk in half with a medication is worth it to the patient. Mm-hmm. And then there's other models that can be used, too. But the GALE model is one of the standard
ones. All right, so you can...
Yeah, and I just want to comment about the GALE model, and Jeannie knows this as well. It doesn't include obesity, for example, and it doesn't include really paternal side as well as it should. But the other models are so confusing and difficult for primary care doctors and patients to use. That's really the advantage of seeing a genetics counselor. And, you know, the drugs to reduce the risk, unfortunately, do have unpleasant and sometimes serious side effects. But so this is a very complex issue that does need some counseling. And are we going to be talking about prophylactic surgery at some point, too?
Yeah. Hang on 1 second. I think, and we can come back to that. I think that would be a good next point. I'm interested in making sure that our listeners know that if they're here are some of these websites mentioned, and they don't get them written down. If you go to kska.org/line1, we have a number of websites that are linked that you can go to get this kind of information. How does tamoxifen decrease the risk of breast cancer? What's the mechanism there? That's what I was curious
about.
Well,
the simple way that I explain to patients is it blocks estrogen from binding to breast cancer cells. It's technically called a SERM, or selective estrogen receptor modulator, but it preferentially will bind to the estrogen receptor rather than estrogen in certain tissues, such as breast and bone, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's actually helpful for bone. It can help strengthen your bones if you have thin bones.
Mm-hmm. So,
but it does have other side effects, too.
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Blood clots, pulmonary embolus, a rare risk of serious uterine cancer.
That's right. Those are small risks, but they are definitely there. And that's where you have to do a risk-benefit analysis in deciding whether or not to prescribe a medication. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes.
So for me, the message is that there exist these options that women, sometimes men, need to be talking with their providers about, and helping with their providers make these individual decisions about how these individual risks might be greater or less than an individual, and how you feel personally about taking those particular risks. Is that part of the message here?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So I think a very important issue is preventative mastectomy, which is, I think, what you're bringing up. Susan, you want to talk about when that might be suggested and the pros and cons from your point of view?
Well, again, neither Jeannie or I are breast surgeons, but for years we have been recommending that women who are gene carriers consider having prophylactic surgery. These BRCA1 and 2 genes are also linked to ovarian cancer risks, and sometimes just removing the ovaries does reduce the risk of breast cancer by about 50%. And then we have also suggested for years the idea of doing prophylactic breast surgery. And again, these are decisions that we encourage women to make. You know, you have to balance between the age of occurrence of breast cancer in their family versus their desire to complete their family, to, you know, find a husband, to have children. And so we usually do recommend this for consideration after completion of childbearing. But that's, again, a very personal decision that they have to discuss with their doctors. And a recent study did show that the prophylactic mastectomy, or removing both breasts in these women, was extremely effective.
What's the
Not 100%, because we can't remove all breast tissue, but very successful.
So the point is, in certain women with certain clear increased risks,
gene carriers,
the BRCA1 and 2, there is the option to significantly decrease their lifetime risk of dying from breast cancer by removal of breast tissue. And my understanding, incidentally, and this is a small part, is you can never be sure you're going to get rid of all the breast tissue. I'd like to know if that's true or not, but I've read that. But second is, what's the downside then? Why not do that?
Well, the bottom line is that breasts are very important for women's self-image, for feeling good about themselves. If you want to nurse your baby, for example, they do have a biological role.
Okay.
And they are important in women's sexuality. We get a lot of sensation from breasts. And so I do take issues sometimes with the surgeons who blithely talk about doing prophylactic mastectomy because it really does impair self-image and pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't talk about pleasure very often for women. Women's sexuality is frequently other-oriented rather than personal pleasure. And removing the breasts and doing a mastectomy, even with the best reconstructive surgery or implants, the breasts are insensate. They have no sensation after that.
Okay. Jeannie, any comments about
that? No, I agree with her. I think it's really a very small percentage of people who there's a strong recommendation or consideration for prophylactic mastectomy. The BRCA1 and 2 breast cancer genes, 1 and 2, account for about no more than 10% of breast cancer cases.
Okay. And what I remember recommending, just for my own edification, is that even if you have a prophylactic mastectomies, it is not 100% guarantee that you would not have breast cancer because you're never sure you're going to get all the breast tissue. Does that ring true to anybody?
I think it's a very small percentage.
Okay. So it's not something you really got to worry about that much.
It's about 1%,
okay.
Probably.
Okay.
And BRCA, I learned recently, refers to Berkeley, California, where the gene was discovered. Hmm. I'm not sure if that was a joke, but it was told seriously.
Can we move on to some individual breast cancer treatment decisions? Susan, any comments that before we do that you want to make?
I'll talk about that. I just really encourage women, when they get a new diagnosis of breast cancer, to really take your time. It's, for most women, it's not an alive or not kind of decision. And we have decades of study with lumpectomy and radiation combinations, for example, showing that it's at least equally effective as mastectomy. There are good, excellent reconstructive options available, both here in Alaska and in national cancer centers outside. That there are, Jeannie, I hope we'll talk a little bit about Oncotat DX as being a way of looking at different ways of staging breast cancer. The traditional methods of staging really had to do with just size of tumor, number of nodes, how it looked under the microscope, and then checking a few receptors. But I encourage patients to get as much knowledge as possible, and that does usually involve getting additional tests like an MRI to see the to take another way of looking at the breasts. Think about getting an Oncotype DX. Think about if you're young or you have a strong family history, checking to see if you're a breast gene carrier, just to decide if you want to try to save the other breast. And there's plenty of time. You don't have to rush in and have your breast removed. Get 2-3 opinions.
Jeannie, what are the factors that are the most important to you, the ones you almost always go over with families, or parents, patients, when discussing breast cancer treatment? What are the things you want to know when helping women make these decisions?
Well, I am a medical oncologist, and generally I see these patients after they've had their definitive surgery. Mm-hmm. There are situations where the patients will be referred to me to receive chemotherapy before surgery, and in that situation, it's generally done in order to shrink the tumor so that the surgeon can go in and do either a lumpectomy, if that's what the patient chooses, and to get an adequate resection.
Is that appropriate that patients go through surgeons generally first before they get to this adjunctive therapy? Or would you say maybe it should be the other way around for the best possible care?
It's not necessary for the best possible care. Some people will go and receive all opinions up front. In general, a medical oncologist cannot give any definitive opinions until we have all the final pathology information. And also, pretty much all of the surgeons in Anchorage who operate on the breasts are very good surgeons, and they really do know the important features that patients need to hear in order to make their upfront decisions. Certainly, if a patient wants to get in and see a medical oncologist before surgery, that can be done, but there's mm-hmm. usually only very generalities that can be given.
Okay.
But once the patient does come to see me, the factors that are important are the stage, meaning size of the tumor, lymph node status, aggressiveness, excuse me, of the tumor, and Susan's implying also an additional test that can sometimes be done on generally favorable tumors that are estrogen receptor positive. But we get some additional studies done on the breast tissue on all cases, and that is whether or not the tumor cells express estrogen and or progesterone receptor, and that refers to whether they're considered hormone sensitive or not. And then an additional marker is done called something called HER2NU, which is a sign of a more aggressive tumor, generally present about 20 or 25% of cases, and generally is treated with more aggressive medical management along with targeted therapy against this an antibody targeted against this protein. So those would be the main things. And then also taking into consideration what the patient's other medical conditions are, what their age is, what's their ability to potentially tolerate treatment, and what their preferences are. Often once I've received all this information, then I tell the patient my estimated risk of recurrence without any further medical therapy, or what the decrease would be in risk of relapse with additional medical therapy such as chemotherapy or anti-estrogen treatment or targeted therapy such as Herceptin towards the HER2 protein. And then it depends on what the patient wants to take in risks and for decreasing recurrence rates.
So
yes,
I agree
with that, and I just you mentioned the three receptors, estrogen, progesterone, and HER2NU. And, you know, the Oncotype DX does check for a total of 23 receptors. And as we're doing more of these genomic tests on the actual tumor tissue itself, we have been identifying many more types of breast cancer. The Oncotype DX is now available even for Medicare patients. When my mother was diagnosed with it initially, her oncologist decided for her, without really discussing it with her, you know, that Oncotype DX wasn't covered by Medicare, therefore she wouldn't want it. But it is a useful test for certain women because you can help identify women who clearly would not benefit from chemotherapy, that, you know, the simpler types of treatments are all that they need. And frankly, we sometimes scare women into thinking that all breast cancers need chemotherapy when we know with the Oncotype DX that at least 50% of them have low risk for recurrence.
Right. I agree with Susan. Absolutely not everybody needs chemotherapy, and it always gets, or certainly should always, be individualized and personalized for the patient. And the Oncotype DX does refine further the prognosis of patients who generally have a overall better prognosis because they are hormone-sensitive tumors, mm-hmm. and it gives a little bit more detailed information on gene expression. But as I said, there's a number of factors that need to be taken into consideration.
So the big message, I'm always the big thinker, I want people to hear the right message here, is that all breast cancers are not the same. You can't just think of these as there's a breast cancer and this has got X is going to happen and so forth. Now we know that they act differently, they respond differently, and we can identify some of the factors that contribute to that difference in activity so that it adjusts, or I should say personalize, the options for treatment. Is that the point we're trying to make here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and Jeannie, you know, in terms of like the hormone receptors, what we used to call triple negatives, people didn't have receptors for hormones, didn't have a receptor for HER2-new. There's now even targeted therapy being directed toward these women who traditionally would have been considered poor prognosis. And I don't know if you want to talk about PARP inhibitors, but just to let people know that phrase is out there.
Mm-hmm. I can mention that for patients in whom our main option for decreasing recurrence rates after they have their local therapy, and really we're maybe I'll back up a little bit. We've jumped ahead because I'm a medical oncologist to start talking about medical options. But generally, the first step in management with a very careful approach, as Susan is saying, is usually surgery, and then chemotherapy, if that's going to be done, radiation, if indicated, and then onto hormonal therapy, if indicated. But once the local management is done, these measurements of receptors is important. And in the situation where all three are negative, then generally we do not have targeted therapy to offer. And in general, targeted therapy is safer with fewer side effects than standard chemotherapy. And Susan's mentioning there's research ongoing in a new class of biological therapy for these triple-negative tumors with PARP inhibitors. At this point, though, those are still investigational. They're not commercially available. And as much as we like to have research protocols open in Anchorage and do have 10 or 15 for breast cancer patients, there's not the availability of PARP inhibitors right now here in Anchorage, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. What about radiation therapy? There's clearly advances in the medical management. Are there advantages, or have there been significant advances in radiation therapy? And who and in what situations is that come into play?
Well, we have invited Dr. Halligan, who is the medical director of radiation oncology at Providence Cancer Center, uh-huh. to come give a talk about updates on individualizing radiation therapy.
Okay.
Because traditionally, women who needed radiation needed 6 to 7 weeks. There's now shortened durations available for certain women. There's a procedure called mammocytes that can be used for local areas. But again, it's highly individualized. And it's part of your medical oncology team, you know, which I regard as being a surgeon, a medical oncologist, a radiation therapist, and I add to that list a plastic surgeon. And these are the people that you may want to, it's perfectly okay to consult with them even as you're making your decision instead of going through it as a stepwise process, i.e. surgery first, oncology next, radiation last. Sometimes understanding your options best doesn't involve getting a consultation from all of these specialists before you make a final decision.
A couple comments more.
Yeah, we've got about 4 minutes left just to make sure everybody knows where we are. Okay.
A couple more comments on radiation. There is actually now with longer follow-up of some of the original studies suggesting that patients with just a few positive lymph nodes might benefit from radiation. So there are situations where a woman will have a mastectomy and then still radiation will be recommended. So it doesn't always avoid radiation completely. And in younger women, there are higher risks of recurrences with longer follow-up. And so sometimes radiation is a little bit more aggressive based on age.
Another thing that I would like to ask about is my understanding, remember I'm a pediatrician, not treating cancer, that the side effects of chemotherapy have also changed dramatically, or at least in the sense that they're much less severe and more tolerable than they used to be. Is that a fair statement to make for breast cancer chemotherapy, since we're that's what we're talking about?
I think getting through chemotherapy is still a tough go.
Okay.
We have a lot of supportive care to help nausea and vomiting. We've got actually clinical trials ongoing now to help prevent nerve damage, which can be a long-term side effect. We're more carefully monitoring bone health. So there are supportive care that can help decrease side effects. I'd like to mention, since we're getting close to the end, a topic that we haven't talked about is other things that women can do to help decrease risk of recurrence. And for pretty much all of the patients who come see me, I recommend regular exercise. And that can be done in a supervised program called Oncology Rehab, and recommending healthy diet, probably similar to American Heart Association, but high in fruits and vegetables. And some of these can help decrease risk of recurrence also.
We have one quick caller. Mary, you're on line one. We just got a couple of minutes. What can we do for you?
Hi, this is Dr. Mary Stewart, and I'm a colleague of Jeannie Anderson. I just want to thank Jeannie and Susan for getting this information out there. I'm old enough to have enough perspective to say that the treatment of breast cancer has improved enormously in the last few years. Please, women, get your mammograms, check your breasts, take care of yourself. Get the exercise, watch your diets. Okay, that's all.
Thanks for taking the time, Mary. All right, last minute. Give me a quick summary of what we want to make sure everyone's hearing. Jeannie, you got any comments?
Well, I think my colleague, Dr. Stewart, did a great job. Take care of yourself, but pay attention to early signs and symptoms, and don't ignore what you think might be wrong. I guess the other thing is, don't take no for an answer. If you feel like there's something wrong with you, don't assume that what one physician or one friend or person tells you, oh, it's nothing, don't worry about it. If you have a gut feeling that there's something wrong, push till you get some answers. And if you're uncomfortable with a doctor's recommendation about treatment, then ask for more information and consider getting a second opinion.
Susan?
Yes, and I totally agree. And I want to emphasize that we had a study published in Alaska within this last year exploring the needs of breast cancer survivors in Alaska. And the bottom line that came out from that is that women want more information at every step of the process, and they want it face-to-face with their healthcare providers, and they want individualized information at both diagnostic and screening tests, treatment options, complementary services, psychological services, support for themselves and their families, and more information about the issues of daily living. And again, you know, Jeannie talked about this, but if you don't need chemo, don't get it just because your friends had it 10 years ago when that was the standard of care. It's a very, as Susan Love says, it's the slash and burn toxic treatment. Our treatments are improving.
Well, listen, thanks very much to both of you for taking the time out of your day. Susan, for joining us by telephone, and Jeannie Anderson for being here in the studio. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yes, thank you so much, and hope to see you at the conference.
Line 1 will return next week with State Immunization Program Manager, Nurse Practitioner Laura Wood, and the State Epidemiologist, Dr. Joe McLaughlin. We're going to be talking about influenza and its prevention. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Thanks for listening, and especially to those who took the time to call. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.